Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
It's almost a cliche to talk about how polarized we are, how divided we have become, especially with COVID going on. Social media algorithms, you know, they're simultaneously outraging us and reinforcing us at the same time. And the walls go up and everybody else becomes the other. And they're impossible to reach. They're a lost cause. We are right and righteous. They are wrong and awful and evil. And I know this happens a lot out there. I've also noticed that it's happening within specific groups. And we've seen this in the atheist movement. You'll find it within specific political parties, with people who hold to a specific religion or philosophy or whatever. There are, I don't know if the word purity tests, I'm not sure if that's exactly the term I'm looking for, but you know what I mean. If you don't line up, if you are not in total agreement on something, if you want to discuss something, or you want to endorse having a discussion with someone else about something, the tribe turns on you. So we find ourselves having difficulty with conversations without and within. That's why I've titled this broadcast, Impossible? Question mark. Conversations. How do we engage? How do we change minds if we're not talking about stuff, if we're not talking to each other, if we're always assuming the worst about somebody we disagree with, if we're assuming that we're always right and cannot be wrong on this issue? You know, I mean, we're all human beings. Who hasn't been wrong about something? Who else has been wrong about something without being the devil? We do this all the time with people. You're not just wrong, you're bad. And if you're bad, you're human garbage. And if you're garbage, we should cast you out. And everybody ends up being an extreme example of somebody who has to be kicked around. And I'm like, well, not everybody fits that description. Where's the consideration and thoughtfulness? When did we become binary thinkers? I want to get into impossible conversations. And on tap, I've got a couple of mental health professionals, two psychologists. They're going to get into kind of what's happening inside of our skulls and how we might be able to have difficult conversations and perhaps become more effective out there in the arena of ideas. Now, obviously, our conversation about conversation today, it's about attitudes and perception. But Wondrium has a great tie-in, a great series about tactics and strategies. It's called How to Speak So That People Want to Listen. And you may have seen one of the many TED Talks by the instructor Julian Treasure out of Cambridge. He's a communication expert, and he gets into the instruments of the human voice, how it sounds, why it matters, mechanics of communication, pacing and flow, and making your points in the most effective way you can, and then not misunderstanding points made by other people. I walked away from this Wondrium series with some stuff I want to implement in my own life, especially when it comes to effective listening. Man, that really resonated with me. Wondrium's library of content is just so vast. So many subjects, science and history, religion, language, documentary films, so much more, brought to you by credible experts who know what they're talking about and who also make learning a lot of fun. So as curious, learning-minded podcast listeners, I know you're going to love Wondrium right now. Wondrium's offering my listeners a special deal, a free 22-day trial offer to celebrate the new year. But you got to sign up with my special URL, wondrium.com/Seth. Again, that's wondrium.com/Seth. And get your learning on today, wondrium.com/Seth. so thankful to talk to my two special guests today. I've got clinical psychologist Dr. Hector Garcia. He's author of several books, including Alpha God, The Psychology of Religious Violence and Oppression. He's also written Sex, Power, and Partisanship, How Evolutionary Science Makes Sense of Our Political Divide. And I've also got Dr. Valerie Tirico, psychologist, author of Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light, and the book The Dark Side, How Evangelical Teachings Corrupt Love and Truth. Both of my guests have been doing a lot of speaking and writing about discourse in our modern age. Dr. Garcia, Dr. Tirico, thank you so much for coming.
Great to be
Thanks
here.
Yes, it's an honor to be back.
I wish I was there lying on the the psychologist couch or the psychiatrist couch where you sit back and share and unload and cry, because I felt the need to do that in the last few years. I tend to get overwhelmed by the state of the world and social media isn't helping. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of that. I don't think we're wired for the fire hose of information, often bad news, that gets shot into our faces, into our eyes and ears.
It has been an eventful past few years, since 2016 onward, I think.
Yeah, I keep saying, how did we get into this version of the multiverse, and can we go back to the other one?
I'm going to go to the word discourse. Discourse, defined as the use of words to exchange thoughts and ideas. Formal and orderly and usually extended expression of thoughts on a particular subject. Let's just dive right into the deep end. It's the year 2022. Is discourse dead?
I think it's damaged. It feels like we have this bifurcation of thought and ideas that means that most of us increasingly are trafficking in partial truths. But also that those partial truths, because of the nature of social media, are becoming more and more simplistic, even the ones that are ascendant.
Meaning that what, people want to parse it down to the simplest version, which may not necessarily be honest?
Exactly. And I think that's true for a lot of well-intentioned people, right? But as I told my daughters growing up, it's not enough to have good intentions. You also have to be right. If you want to do good in the world, you also have to be right about the real world contingencies, the causes and effects that govern our well-being and the well-being of people or other sentient beings. And when we distill everything down to sound bites and tweets, and then we, on top of that, split them into two tribes of partial truths, of each of us only carrying, you know, kind of a specific set in antagonism with each other, we might as well be plucking daisies.
It's Thunderdome out there. Dr. Hector Garcia, is nuance dead? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think there have been times in our history where tribalism has bubbled up and conversations across the aisle, so to speak, have been more difficult, you know, during the social upheaval of the civil rights movement, the McCarthy era, since the 2016 election. But I do think that the advent of the internet and social media complicates things. It inundates us with information. I think a lot of people lack media literacy, and there are a lot of powerful moneyed interests that ping our tribalistic instincts in a way that's really distilled, really potent. They know how to do that. And so there are a lot of messages coming through the airwaves intentionally designed to provoke division. And we have to be careful of that. And we have to understand it.
It's funny. I was having a conversation with Natalie the other day about something. We're just talking. We're just, you know, sitting up in bed and we're on our phones. The dogs are in our laps. And we're talking about, I don't know, a furniture purchase or a trip or something. And all of a sudden, ads for that very thing started to appear on my social media and in my Google searches. It was freaky, right? So what you're saying is that these entities know my buttons and they know how and when to push them.
Sure. And what we saw during the 2016, the 2020 elections is foreign interest manipulating our tribalistic hot buttons. They manipulate that through divisive memes or just content coming over social media. So, yes, to make money, to divide, there's a lot of reasons to be aware of you know, some of the pitfalls in our evolved psychology that make conversations difficult.
Dr. Tirico, sorry, they're friends of mine. So I'm like in my casual voice, want to be like, Hector, Val, how you doing? Good to talk to you. But you posted something early January that I want to address here because I don't have enough hate mail. You said, before social media, people were often judged by their deeds. Now they are mostly judged by their opinions. Being quote unquote good requires no kindness, only the right memes and hashtags. And those revered as saints need no heart of gold, only a silver tongue and brazen nature. And that's a quote from someone whose name I can't even pronounce. Can you help me out with that? It's Gerwinder something or what?
Yeah, I don't know how it's pronounced.
For those who are interested, it's Gerwinder, last name Bhogal. But this is interesting. Because we've seemed to have reset the bar for what's good by, I have this opinion that makes me a good person. You are wrong in your opinion. You are now a bad person. Is that where you're going?
I think it's a function in part of social media and the fact that younger people are increasingly living in a virtual world instead of in the physical world, right? So that then you look at what does that mean in terms of politics? It means that what matters is perception, kind of shaping of perceptions, signaling that you are a righteous person, that you're part of a specific tribe, as opposed to kind of doing this like roll up your sleeves work, for example, in the area where I focus most in family planning, right, and reproductive empowerment, that it's more appealing to a lot of folks to signal their support for abortion rights by posting memes and quotes and kind of or even staging protests than to do the painstaking, slow, not sexy, not visible work of figuring out what does it take to empower people to, you know, kind of have the information they need and the contraceptives they need to form the families of their choosing. That's just one example. And I think that social media has made it worse. And then, of course, like the last 2 years, things have been on steroids because COVID forced us all into our caves, even more so than before. Instead of living in the physical world, we're now living in these virtual worlds where what matters is social hierarchy and status and standing and perceptions of our in-group.
So I know someone who is in my family. They're an evangelical. They are staunchly anti-abortion. In that model, I would go on Twitter and I would say, we need to stand up for the reproductive rights of women worldwide. And somebody jumps in the comment section and says, I oppose abortion at all costs because a fetus is a human life. I then am judging them based on an opinion that they have, not on whether or not they are in every other aspect of their life a good person, or maybe even also whether they're motivated by good because they genuinely think that they have to protect what they consider to be a life. I don't know. Am I close? Am I in the ballpark on that?
Yeah, what you also don't know is that person making, you know, there's two ways to reduce unmet need for abortion, right? One is to increase access to abortion. The other is to reduce unintended, unsought, unwanted pregnancy. And so, you know, just based on this opinion about abortion, you don't know what they're doing that would either increase unmet need or decrease unmet need. It's just verbiage.
So it's very possible that in their circle, religious or otherwise, they might be working to help create preventative measures and other options so that unwanted pregnancy does not happen, whether it's sex ed or something else. I don't know that. I simply assume they want to make abortions illegal because, I don't know, they hate women or because of the patriarchy or whatever.
And we make this leap from opinions to a moral judgment about the person. I think that's also what you were getting at, right? So you have this opinion that's external to my tribe. And then there's this level of visceral reaction to that. And then we judge you to be a bad person, or even we go so far as to, you know, kind of say, you know, and the kind of the automatic words on the left are you're a racist or you're a Nazi or you're a sexist.
I think of myself. I used to be that guy. I was staunchly anti-abortion or quote unquote pro-life. And I was a Christian nationalist and I had all these other bad ideas. I distrusted science and scientists and I was a young earth creationist and I was all these things. I wasn't a bad guy. I genuinely wanted to be good. I wanted to be about good things. I wanted goodness to prevail. And I wonder if I had gone online and expressed my opinions in my evangelical years, how I would be approached today, maybe even vilified today. Dr. Garcia, you got anything on this one you want to weigh in?
Well, something that stood out about what Valerie was saying was signaling, the virtue signaling. I mean, that the power of tribal opinion is so huge. And I think beliefs have been a signal of commitment throughout our history. I mean, if you believe X, Y, or Z myth or whatever having to do with religion, you're virtuous. If you believe a slight variation of that, you're the enemy. And, you know, that has been the source of warfare throughout the Middle Ages and even today. So I think, yeah, beliefs, stated beliefs, especially if they're stated publicly, I think those are often signs of commitment to the tribe. And they're very hard to break, even if they're irrational. You know, we've talked before about beliefs about COVID being a hoax or vaccines being poison or being, you know, injected with tracking devices, at, you know, at the command of Bill Gates or something like that. That is how these tribal beliefs become poisonous, because they cannot be challenged out of fear of going against the tribe. I think that's huge.
I've seen that in all kinds of communities and all kinds of tribes, whether it's the atheist movement or whether it's conservatives or liberals, Republican, Democrats, I mean, whatever. There is somebody who is not toeing the line, who's not 100% in agreement. Maybe they just have a bad idea or what someone else perceives as a bad idea. And there are serious consequences. The call-outs begin, the invective kicks in, everybody turns on them, and they get to the point where either they feel ostracized and run for the door, or they just shut up, sit on their hands, and the next time they want to express something that is a question, a comment, an opinion, or whatever, they don't say a damn thing because, oh my God, I don't want to call down the whirlwind again. Tribes will turn on those who don't line up.
Well, the irony is that also happened in the so-called free thought movement, where conversations feel dangerous sometimes, and there are forbidden topics, and there are heresies and taboos that you cannot bring up for fear of rejection from your tribe mates. And, you know, as a free thinker, I do see immense value in being able to have conversations about anything.
I used to say truth has a liberal bias. Obviously, coming from the left half of the political spectrum, with my core passion being about reproductive rights and empowerment and contraceptive technologies and climate change and, you know.
Sure. I mean, you and I line up. We would be considered left or liberal. Yeah.
But so I used to say that truth has a liberal bias. And then more recently, I said I would say truth has a liberal bias, but I'm not sure that liberals have a truth bias. I mean, lately, I'm not even sure that progressives, which I also identify with, have a liberal bias, meaning there's so much orthodoxy of thought. There are so many taboos. There are so many kind of questions you're not allowed to ask and kind of topics you're not allowed to explore that it starts feeling like we've almost come full circle to something that is reminiscent of the conservative Christian orthodoxy that I grew up in.
Well, I think some of what I'm hearing, though, is, well, this is settled. Like, discussing it actually diminishes those that we are trying to fight for, right? This is settled law, morally settled law.
I keep thinking about a forbidden conversation. I'm just going to say out loud, woke culture. That's a forbidden word, I think, in many circles. I mean, it's a hard, you can't even say that without, you can't even examine whether or not that exists and how it may exist and its internal dynamics.
All right, if you're going to pull the trigger on a word like woke or wokeism, can we talk about that? I mean, with nuance. From my own perspective, I've seen overreach from people who, you know, have just kind of gone off the deep end. But I've also seen a lot of the use of the word woke to marginalize good people who are interested in real social justice.
Well, I can take a shot at that. So the word woke goes back decades, and it comes out of Black culture and the idea of people just kind of being aware of systemic racism, for example. So there's an extra kind of complexity, I think, to the fact that over time it got adopted by a large swath of the left as a aspirational word, and now is increasingly associated with stigma, or it's being used as a derisive word. All of which has very good reasons around it, but it's a lot of complexity there in terms of a word that was key to Black enlightenment and becoming for people who are worried very much about cultural appropriation actually having taken over that word, and then the fact that it's become derisive in part because of the excesses, not of ordinary Black people who are kind of mindful of America's racial history, obviously, because they've had to live it, but because of the excesses of a group of activists who have kind of taken up some ugly, I think, sometimes ways of behaving and some not constructive ways of thinking.
It's a silly putty word. I mean, when I throw it out, it's really become super subjective.
Certainly it had been co-opted by the Fox News set, right, and used as pejorative. But that doesn't mean that there's nothing there, and that doesn't mean that the psychology isn't worth rational examination. And I often like to differentiate between cancel culture and taking away platforms from dangerously incendiary people, the Trumps of the world, the Alec Jones of the world, as opposed to just summarily cutting somebody off for the slightest infraction, for the slightest misspoken word. I think there's a difference there worth contemplating.
Yeah, but I mean, let's say I'm interested in a specific social justice issue, and that could relate to race or the prison systems or the role of government or healthcare, foreign policy or whatever. And somebody says, oh, you're just trying to be uber woke. That's designed as a way to shut me down.
Well, I think that list of concerns that you just spelled out is something that I think the three of us all share as objectives, as social objectives. And when I talk about the subculture that has kind of sprung up and where this word gets labeled, first where it was embraced and now where it kind of gets used in sometimes more stigmatizing or derisive terms, is a more specific kind of thing. Eckler mentioned cancellation as being part of that, as one of the strategies around it. There is kind of the ideas of deplatforming and punching up and trigger warnings or calling out that is kind of lumped into some of the more, both the tools of that culture and then in their excesses, some of the negatives of that culture. But as a psychologist, I recently wrote an article about why having an excessively woke therapist might actually not be helpful for mental health. And the reason is because within this subculture, there are some cognitive and interpersonal dynamics that run pretty counter to what we know about healthy emotional and psychological and interpersonal functioning from decades now of evidence-based therapies, for example. So I'm talking about, you know, emotional reasoning, that if you feel something, then it is necessarily true. Part of what we work on as therapists is trying to help people take a step back from their feelings and to say, you know, feelings are shaped by our personal history, by our family history, by our evolutionary history, and they're important to attend to, but they can be exaggerated or distorted or misapplied. And so part of what you're trying to do is create a balance between the cognitive self as observer and the person who is just experiencing a gut reaction. But one of the trends in woke subculture is if somebody says, I feel insulted, unsafe, etc., then you take that as if that was all the information you needed, and that it then demands them to be protected from whatever it is that they just said they were feeling. So that's one example. There's several other dimensions of this in which I think that there are patterns that have gotten elevated within woke subcultures. And again, like you're right, there's no great term for it. All of them kind of become pejorative sooner or later, the kind of social justice warriors kind of, you know, people, because the right grabs onto any term that left activists use to label themselves. But even so, I think there is substance there that has to do with some of these patterns, and I'm happy to talk about others if you want to take the time to do that.
Yeah, let me camp out here for just a second. So if I'm to understand what you're saying, there is in some instances a mindset where I am being given the responsibility for the reaction of someone whose history I do not know. I don't know what specific biases they have, what damage may have been done in their lives. And I may be doing or saying something innocuous that quote unquote triggers or offends or makes them feel unsafe. And I have no idea, like I'm just saying or doing something innocuous. But from your perspective, we may have gone so far that people may not be, saying it out loud, I know someone's going to misinterpret, but they're not taking enough personal responsibility. More offense is taken than it is given. Would that be a way to frame it?
So I would pivot this to Hector because he works with trauma on a day-to-day basis, right? And I think that we have there's been this pattern sometimes on the left and as a way of getting attention to harms that have been done, both current harms and historic harms, that we have deployed what some might call harm inflation. So we take words like trauma or triggered or whatever, and we kind of apply them to a broader spectrum of experiences. But then we aren't really addressing those things in the same way that an expert in trauma would actually suggest that they be addressed.
Dr. Hector Garcia, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I agree. You know, trauma in the vernacular sense is very different than trauma per, you know, the diagnostic manual that we use to diagnose psychiatric condition. You know, trauma in that context is, you know, a threat to life and integrity or something of that nature where we really feel like, you know, an event either took life or put our life at risk. But I think there are so many apt metaphors between some of the reactions that Valerie was talking about and the clinical world, because, you know, among trauma survivors, over responding to traumas is not adaptive. You know, it's not adaptive when you impute negative intentions to other people when they may or may not have those intentions at all. It's not adaptive to see things in all or none terms. You know, you have to see nuance to function properly. So just as the idea you were mentioning earlier, Seth, that if you say anything about, you know, an interest in social justice, you're woke, that's all or none thinking. Just as if you slip up once, you must be canceled and you must be with the enemy camp. You know, these are very extreme reactions. We have to see subtlety because subtlety is often reality.
I was talking to the host of Cognitive Dissonance, Tom and Cecil, and Tom said, I like the way he phrased it when he was talking about dealing with people in this often very sensitive and sometimes overly sensitive culture. But he said, you know, we've got to start giving people some grace. And I like the way that sounds. I like the way it rolls off the tongue. And, you know, it doesn't mean we're sellouts. It doesn't mean that we're excusing everything they do, but, you know, not assuming the worst. And then we get into what personal responsibility, you know, how responsible am I for the buttons that I allow other people to push? When is it me overreacting versus when is it genuinely offensive and traumatizing? And I know with the words personal responsibility that someone's going to come after me because they think I'm marginalizing genuine offense. I certainly hope not. But
well, you use the words personal responsibility. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you got dinged for that because those words, like many others, have a partisan tag at this point. But I think about it in terms of agency. So one of the ways that people who are trying to work on social justice affect that or push for that is they focus on systemic factors that affect individuals. But that is what psychologists call an external locus of control. And the alternative to that is focusing on personal agency and the power that people have, even under adverse circumstances, to take care of themselves and the people around them to create their best possible lives. I think of college, the extreme example of this, reading Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, which he literally wrote kind of coming out of a Nazi concentration camp, talking about how to utilize the agency that you have regardless of your circumstances. And so I think that there are two different pieces of this, right? The power of the system and the culture and what we can change and improve people's lives by changing that. And then there is also this internal power that people have to a greater or lesser degree. And it's a painful and bizarre thing to me that those two pieces of reality have gotten split into two different buckets. And depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on, you're only allowed to talk about one of them.
Speaking to some odd things that I think are often done with really good intentions, I'm reminded of, I can't remember whether it was a campus, a college campus somewhere, but it was suggested by a person or organization that people stop applauding at particular events because the sound of clapping, the noise might traumatize someone. And I know this is an extreme example, but that's what I think of when I hear someone use woke culture as a pejorative. And even you and I are probably thinking, well, I mean, I appreciate the sentiment behind it. You know, someone's genuinely trying to be nice and accommodating, but it really is kind of ridiculous. Banning applause or discouraging applause because someone's traumatized by clapping, to me, just seems kind of nuts. And I think that's the stuff that the Fox Newsers, et cetera, go after. They see that story and they're like, aha, the left has totally lost its mind. When I think many of us who are proud liberals, we also think it's overreach. We also think it doesn't make much sense.
For example, you know, you see this in you know, the American Psychological Association recently released suggested language to use in, for example, terms to avoid killing it. And they suggest alternatives. Great job. Awesome. Instead of saying killing it, for having accomplished something, for having mastered something. And some of the comments are that there are other ways to say so without equating it to murder. And I'm quoting this.
So if you say, hey, you know, Seth really killed it when he spoke at the convention, the suggestion is that may remind someone of homicide. Is that what they're talking about?
Or even taking a shot, take your best shot, pull the trigger, you know, like engage. A suggested alternative, give it a go, try. And the comments that they offered is that these expressions needlessly use image of hurting someone or something. That's going a bit too far. We can't create a padded world for everybody. That's not reality, and it doesn't help people.
I was having a conversation about, of all historical people, Adolf Hitler. And I referenced the madman, Adolf Hitler. And I was criticized for marginalizing mentally ill people for using the word madman. Of course, I'm using it in the colloquial sense. But I mean, these are great examples where, you know, we can be about justice, but we don't want to become a punchline. You know, I mean, there is a line where at some point we're going to have to manage the buttons that we think other people are trying to push. I'm not saying that we're not operating with history and biases, wounds, scars, with baggage, and that's important. But at some point, I mean, how much power are we going to allow other people to have over us? And how accommodating are we going to force them to be toward us? I don't think that's a statement of privilege. That seems to me like good sense. I don't know. Dr. Tirico, you got anything on that?
Well, I guess I would say that I just don't think that that is cost-free. When people are that hypervigilant about language, about perceiving other people around them as fragile, it takes a lot of energy. And I think it distracts from the substantive real world work of asking, what do we have to do on the ground in the real world to make people's lives better? And I think to some degree, it also is belittling.
Would that fall under the category of maybe a bigotry of diminished expectations?
I think that's what people are saying.
I want to talk more about intent or intention. Is what's happening inside my skull relevant to whatever damage I might be doing, right? Nobody's the villain in their own story. So am I doing actual damage? Does my intent really matter? If that's true, let's talk about that and a lot more with my special guests right after this. We live in a world where it's becoming harder and harder to productively engage and talk to each other. And so we're talking about talking on the broadcast today. I've got authors and educators and activists and psychologists, two special guests, Dr. Hector Garcia and Dr. Valerie Tirico. So glad to have them on the show. We did a show a few years ago about cancel culture. You know, does it exist? What's it look like? Is it a fabrication? And, you know, I think I came away from that particular broadcast because we were talking about some major examples of people who had said and done some awful stuff. I mean, Alex Jones, right? He gets his YouTube account dropped and Twitter drops him. Trump's social media accounts are deleted. People get upset about someone saying and doing genuinely offensive things. And a private entity decides, now we're going to pull the plug, right? Well, I don't see that as cancel culture as much as I see it as consequence culture. But I think it's fair to say that there is some overreach from time to time. I mean, people, offense archaeologists, will just go through and, you know, look for something, some misstep or something they hate or disagree with, or maybe genuinely something awful that happened years ago, and they bring it front and center, put a spotlight on it and say, aha, this person is horrible, terrible, whatever, and they should be canceled. And so I've really developed kind of a complex view of cancel culture. I mean, sometimes I think it's just cause and effect consequences, but there are times when people just totally overreact.
Well, so one thing I would say is that the cancellation stuff doesn't just happen in the case of settled science, right? So I agree, you know, we look at climate science where there's kind of vast agreement about anthropogenic climate change, and then you have Fox kind of finding the rare naysayer and then giving them equal time or whatever. I agree about that we don't need to be platforming people when something is settled. But the other thing that I would say here that I think is most significant about this whole idea of people being canceled or deplatformed is it's not the elite, fancy pants public figures that get canceled that I worry about so much as it is the self-censorship within circles of friends or on Facebook or place like that, where people, like, we now have a majority of college students, I believe, kind of saying that they hold opinions that they're afraid to express. So when you have self-censorship in terms of what you are able to express, you also ultimately get censorship of what questions you're able to entertain. And it doesn't take very many public defenestrations for people to start censoring themselves. So, like, for an example here in Seattle, as both of you know, being accused of racism is one of the most ugly things someone can be accused of in our society. There's broad agreement across the political spectrum that racism is an ugly thing. That consensus got solidified kind of in the years following the civil rights movement. And so it's, you know, as some people have said, being accused of racism is saying you are morally, you've lost your standing. You know, it's like being accused of pedophilia. So we had one of the most effective Planned Parenthood directors in the country until about a month ago. She's someone who had been directing our local affiliate for 30 years. She's like directly responsible for the fact that Planned Parenthood nationally has their own drug company so that they can control pricing for poor women, not only in their own clinics, but for other kind of low income clinics. She's directly responsible for the development of their telemedicine service for rural women who can't get to a clinic easily. She's directly responsible, you know, under her watch for the development of a teen counseling, peer counseling program that then got replicated across the country. And she has kind of taken on floundering affiliates and kind of turned them into thriving affiliates, not alone, of course, but with a team of professionals working with her and under her. So this is a person who's done more for the reproductive empowerment of poor women of color in the Pacific Northwest than perhaps anyone. She lost her job about a month ago because a donor had used the N-word during a conversation, pissed off donors, saying it's like women in Texas are the new N-word. And then this director, behind closed doors with one of her staff, her public affairs staffer, repeated the word rather than censoring it, as if all of our brains don't immediately fill in the asterisks, right? And then that became such a scandal, public scandal, accused of racism, untrustworthy, nobody safe to kind of be working for her because of her poor judgment and racism, right? And so it, to me, is a classic example of form over substance, but also it's an example of the fact that this isn't just somebody who's making $1 million a year doing comedy, right? It's having real consequences for real people.
Well, let's get into the word intent or motive. There are some people who say, your intention isn't important to me. It's only the result. Like, I don't care what motivates you. I don't care what you're thinking. All I know is the results of what you're thinking and doing are harming people, and the results are all we're going to deal with. But I'm interested in intent.
Well, intent does matter. It matters in our criminal justice system. It matters in a lot of different areas. But I think what I find more dangerous is when people impute your thoughts and intentions, right? So somebody could take what you just said and you know, the level of nuance you were attempting to span in your thoughts about cancel culture. Sure, some people deserve canceling. Some people deserve their platforms removed. Some people, perhaps it's done too summarily. Well, if you lack nuance and you hear somebody say that, a common response is, well, you must be fascist for even suggesting such a thing. And it comes from a place of pain, you know, just like, you know, just almost like having experienced a trauma, you know. Valerie published an article recently just talking about how, you know, some of the cognitive errors that we see in the therapy office, you sometimes see among those more prone to cancel culture. And I think anxiety, pain, traumas drive those kinds of cognitive errors, seeing things in black or white terms. And I think in order to heal from a trauma, I think you do have to correct erroneous thinking. You don't want to over-respond. Over-responding is unhealthy. And just because you do that doesn't mean if you experience a trauma that you're condoning any of the traumas that have been perpetrated against you. And I would say the same thing about looking, just because we look at the psychology of cancel culture or wokeism or this issue of conformity among the left, that doesn't mean that we justify any of the prejudices or oppressions probably more often received from those on the far right. You know, overreactions just aren't healthy. And they're often unjust. They often punish people who aren't guilty. They often strain relationships or often self-defeating. You know, if you want to be sympathetic to your cause, you know, reacting with excessive force is going to have the opposite effect.
Dr. Tirico, intention versus results. Your thoughts?
We teach children that intentions matter from kindergarten on, maybe even before, right? Like when you get accidentally bumped by a friend and they knock you down, or when somebody shoves you and knocks you down, it matters. Outcomes also matter, but it's a peculiar thing to dichotomize that in such a way that it has to be one or the other.
There's a term I like to use just because it makes me sound smarter than I am. Motive attribution asymmetry. This relates to how I think that me and my group, we are motivated by love and goodness and righteousness. And my rival group, they must be motivated by hate and wickedness. I am reasonable. The other cannot be reasoned with, right? We just have to steamroll over them because they're a lost cause. Motive, attribution, asymmetry. Either of you deal with this?
It's very much a part of armed conflict. And so when you think about the PTSD treatment that Dr. Garcia does, it's a deliberate, in fact, strategy in armed conflict to kind of dehumanize the other person and to kind of think of their motives as being much inferior to our tribe.
Now, if I may jump in quickly, Dr. Garcia does a lot of work with PTSD sufferers, many of whom have served in the military. Am I accurately representing that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And that's so Dr. Tirico's point is that if you're going to go and do war against somebody, go to battle, if you're going to go out and decimate and destroy the enemy, it helps if they have less of a face, if they are more of a, I don't know, one-dimensional thing, you know, maybe dehumanized, right?
Sure. I mean, this idea of what it's called parochial altruism, where, you know, my group is just, moral, righteous. The other group is unjust, you know, morally decrepit. You know, I think that's kind of an instinctive psychology that we have, that we evolved our time on the African savannas. And that gets played out in war, but it also gets played out in families. It also gets played out in economic classes. It gets played out in political parties. But, you know, as a progressive, I don't like authoritarianism on the left for the same reason I don't like it on the right. It forbids conversation. It divides people. And it's hypocritical. It's almost like, well, we don't like when that happens on the right, but it's okay if we do it, right?
Or it's okay, a cheat.
If we characterize the outside.
Or the right does it so much worse, and this other, they're so much more toxic, that why bother looking at the speck in our own eye? That's often what I hear. It's a distraction. Why in the world would you want to talk about our house? The big problem is their house.
Yeah, and you know, the fascinating thing about this is when we test people across the political spectrum, when we test people who are more prone to cancel culture, what we see is a lot of the very same personological traits as you see on the right, like, for example, right-wing authoritarianism. So this idea that you demonize outsiders, you demand conformity among your tribe mates, so you look up to people in positions of authority. The extreme right and the extreme left share those traits. They also share a difficulty seeing nuance. You're either with me or against me. You either think that all people should be canceled if for a slight infraction, or you don't, period. You know, it's difficulty seeing nuance.
Would I be able to distill that down to the problem is extremism?
I think, yes, extremism, but I think all of this comes from these very ancient survival instincts that, you know, operated on a plane that was filled with danger. In those kinds of environments, nuance could be deadly. there's either a lion behind the bushes or there isn't. No, maybe let's go see. You know, the tribe's either with you or against you. And nuance could get people killed in dangerous environments. So all or none thinking has advantages in, say, for example, a combat theater. But it lacks nuance. And often the world is a lot more complicated than these reactions that are fear-based and therefore distorted. So I think striving towards seeing things more rationally, not seeing things in a positive way, not denying the problems of the outside tribe, but seeing the balance, that's reality.
What I appreciate about this audience, I really feel like that they're taking this journey with us, right? We're sort of walking the minefield a little bit, because when you talk about these hot button issues, I mean, I feel it. I feel, you know, nervous. Like, what if somebody quote mines, or somebody misrepresents, or what if somebody loses their mind? And before you, I want this again to be a broadcast, a discussion about discussions. Can we do that? Can we have nuance? Can we unlayer the onion? Can we approach each other, right or wrong, in good faith and try to figure things out? And how do we do that if we're not communicating with each other? And my hope is everybody who is listening along is, you know, agree, disagree, learn, tell me why I'm wrong or why I'm right or what you support or what you don't. I'd like to think that people are engaging in a productive way.
Well, listen, Seth, as a clinical psychologist, I have learned the value of having difficult conversations that are uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable, but the outcome that you get in terms of insight, it's worth it. It's worth it 1,000-fold.
Yeah, that's different. If I'm sitting across the table from either of you, the temperature of that exchange is a whole lot different than if I just encounter you at random on Twitter. I mean, on Twitter, you're a one-dimensional avatar. In person, I feel like people walk a lot more cautiously. They can see your eyes, your expressions. They hear the tenor of your voice, your body language. And maybe they're just more charitable in general. Dr. Tirico, do you see that distinction, the way people approach each other over coffee as opposed to over social media?
Absolutely. And I think that is one of the reasons why some things have escalated during the pandemic. You know, with the incident I described at Planned Parenthood, it's not clear to me that would have happened if people had been in proximity to each other for the last 2 years. We hear about how the climate in Washington, D.C. was different when people had less access to cheap flights. And so they all kind of had second homes in D.C. and would spend the weekends going out to dinner with each other. And their kids played on the same soccer teams, regardless of which side of the political aisle they were on. It's challenging at a distance. And I think that's emblematic of kind of the dynamic that we just can't afford to have in our culture as a whole if we want to kind of be able to address the very real complicated dynamics that govern our well-being. So if I could ramble on a minute more, a Christian pastor of all people, you know, in Seattle, who wrote this fabulous little book called Crossing the Difference Divide, and it's so short and so simple that even my Swiss cheese brain could retain the concepts. It's just like three very basic concepts that I love so much, I just have to repeat them. So one is, I will be unusually curious about others. The second one is, I will stay in the room with difference. And the third one is, I will stop comparing my best with your worst. And so when I think about what are the kind of conversations that we're trying to facilitate, that goes right to the heart of it for me. Not comparing my best with your worst, being willing to tolerate the discomfort of sitting in the room with difference, and then operating out of a mindset of curiosity rather than judgment.
Do I get high on vanquishing an enemy? Like, I don't know what you'd call it, a dopamine rush or an endorphin rush or something. But, you know, if I go out and feel like I won, do I get paid for that chemically in my brain?
No question. No question. Serotonin and testosterone.
Oh, yeah.
Not only that, but we get that on a group level. And this is where it gets fascinating and relevant to this conversation. When we look at sports teams, so fans of a winning sports team get a boost in testosterone and serotonin. And it drops when their sports team loses because our identity, our very identity, our endocrines are embedded with our group. And that comes from a long history of intertribal conflict. And you know, that I think is sometimes why a particular stance is adhered to so vociferously, and why there's a Teflon coating around certain ideas that are held by the tribe that just cannot penetrate. It just bounces right off of it.
So more than engagement, I just want to win.
Well, winning, I think, is one aspect of trying to just elevate ourselves. And we want to feel superior in a whole bunch of ways. And when the new atheists first started talking and we saw this waning of Christianity, and I realized that we need, you know, kind of religion is a complex set of social technologies, and we needed to replace some of that. It wasn't clear kind of within the waning of religion, how are we going to commemorate the big events of our lives, being born, growing older, forming pair bonds, dying. How would we talk? Where would we talk about issues of meaning and morality? How would we celebrate joy and wonder? What I didn't realize is how incredibly powerful our drive for feeling morally superior is, or superior more broadly. So this drive for righteousness and rightness that we now see kind of, I think, coming out in some different channels as, I think, as a consequence of the fact that religion is on the wane.
You feel like some people mash into their keyboards. They spend all their time or a lot of their time arguing on Twitter, Facebook, etc., because they feel helpless to do anything else.
It certainly can make people feel powerful to rage on the internet. I could see that argument, sure.
I stopped spending too much time like on YouTube comments. You know, when I first started activism, I remember thinking, I'm going to reply to everybody who has an opinion, you know, and this back when there was just a few hundred. And I was struck by, you know, how little good faith there was and how easily I got baited into these time-wasting exchanges that bore no fruit. And at the end of the day, my eyes are red, my fists are clenched, there's a vein popping out of my forehead, my mental health has gone to shit. I'm just, you know, it was terrible. I had to give it up, you know, I just couldn't do it. And I'm not convinced that, I mean, it's not that we shouldn't engage online, but in a nuanced conversation, back to the buttons that are being pushed, back to appropriating, what is a productive use of my time? How much do we want to spend mashing into comment sections on Twitter because we think it's going to affect positive change? I'm not really all that convinced it happens very often.
Well, so often I think we go into it looking for a sense of superiority, right, that we get from that gotcha when we are able to catch someone or be particularly witty in kind of knocking down whatever they said or whatever their argument is. And, you know, I'm not exempt from that. One of the things I've been trying to do recently is to, when I'm reading an article by someone who I largely disagree with, like a free market fundamentalist economist or something, like what I try to do is sit with it and to ask myself, okay, like we already know that we broadly disagree. What is there in here that I can agree with? What is this person saying something when I kind of think about this landscape of partial truths? Is there a partial truth that this person is holding onto or trying to express that I might otherwise miss, or that isn't kind of very prominent in the discourse that's in my tribe? It's super challenging to do that because I want to go in and argue.
I'm guilty. I can turn my snark on. And if I see some horrible statement position video clip by, you know, Ben Shapiro, I'm like, oh my God, it's horrible. You know, and I immediately jump in with the one liner and the jab. So I'm not operating from the moral mountain here, but I'm interested enough to realize that I found a part of my heart started to die. My own humanity became more numb. I was desensitized, depersonalized. I think less effective with other people. I just became struck by how often I had othered, sometimes good people who I'd encountered who deserved better. We disagreed maybe on some things that really matter, but they're not Hitler, right? And I really became aware of that. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation. Any final thoughts on hard conversations, othering, tribes, maybe how we get past and through this as best we can? Dr. Garcia, I'll start with you.
Oh, gosh, just what you're saying right now. I think we are bringing Stone Age brains into the age of technology, and it's an open experience. We're learning as we go along, as we're rushing forward with the wind in our faces. We're learning as we go along, and I think conversations like this are necessary. You know, if we don't do that with an inward look, we're in trouble.
It was through conversations I escaped fundamentalist religion. It was through conversations that I was able to evolve my own thinking. It was a long journey, but man, I'm glad they didn't turn on me when I started saying, you know, kind of stupid stuff. Dr. Tirico, any final thoughts?
Well, just at a pragmatic level, we're not going to change hearts and minds if we go into it with that attitude of figuring out how we can knock somebody else down and leave them feeling lesser. So I think that there is a certain point at which pragmatism and healthy relationships and moral goodness coincide. And that has to do in that intersection of humility and listening and finding common ground.
You're not saying, because I can already hear the comment section, that people need to water down their values, to compromise their values in this exchange, but engaging, listening, speaking, I don't know, working toward a productive conversation can happen out there in the ether as you remain true to yourself.
That fits for me.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure you said it well, but as a host, I like to go back and recap everything because it's the only way I really get to play along with you PhD types. So I always enjoy speaking to both of you. I appreciate the fact that you're so thoughtful, and it's obvious you love people and you want to, you know, you want to change the world. I think you want to, you know, your books and your speeches and your overall presence out there in the mental health world and beyond really do represent the kind of positive, constructive change, the thoughtful exchange that I think the rest of us can really take inspiration from. Dr. Hector Garcia, Dr. Valerie Tirico, it's been an honor. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Seth.
To you.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.